You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome to tonight's talk about Latvia, entitled Latvian Focus, Elections and Russian Policy in the Region. I am delighted to see a fair number of people interested in the developments in Latvia. I am particularly delighted to host our speakers today, Nils Mužniks, who is the director of the Advanced Social and Political Research Institute at the University of Latvia, the chairman of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, and a member of the Soros Foundation Latvia's board. Our second distinguished speaker is Andris Akmanis, who is the executive director of the Soros Foundation Latvia. As you know, in the 20 years of post-Soviet existence, Latvia has gained a reputation of a captured state with very high skepticism and distrust of politics and legal system. The latest clash over the country's anti-corruption body has led to a national referendum, which dismissed early the national legislature. And the new election has been set for this Saturday, September 17th, if I'm not mistaken. This is why I am very happy that our colleagues could join us and be in the United States to provide us with an insight of the trends and developments of Latvia and perhaps the future outlook and the foundation's role in this climate.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Nils Mužniks. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here. Haven't been to New York in a while, and I think this is my first time ever at OSF. My colleague Andris and I will try to provide some insight into what's going on in Latvia, the politics of the economic and political crisis, the politics of the elections, the role of the foundation in trying to address the root causes of the various crises that Latvia has faced, and to try to put it all in a slightly broader regional context. As Olga was saying, we're in the last days of the election campaign. Try to give you a sense of what that campaign is about, what are the key issues, who are the key players. It all ends this Saturday, where Andris and I will have to go to the consulate here in New York and vote. Just briefly, most of you, I'm sure, know where Latvia is, but it's always nice to remember kind of the geography of the region, that Latvia has borders with Russia and Belarus and its two Baltic neighbors, but Lithuania, for example, does not have a land border with mainland Russia, but only with Kaliningrad, which means that in its relations with Russia, it's a slightly different game. For example, when Lithuania joined the EU and NATO, Kaliningrad became an island of Russia within the EU and NATO. And of course, Finland to the north and Sweden to the west. Whenever I lecture on Latvia, but on just about any topic, I always ask the so what question. So what? Who cares about Latvia? Why should anybody be interested in Latvia? And I tried to figure out what makes Latvia particularly interesting, and these are the reasons I came up with. It's managed one of the most severe economic crises in the world. And I'll show some data to back that up in a few minutes. It's still embroiled in one of the most severe political crises in Europe. Show some data to back that up. And it's on the front line with Russia, and I will explain what I mean by that. The economics of the crisis. Latvia has broken a lot of records over the last couple of years. According to the IMF, Latvia had the most severe recession in the world. In 2009, he had a drop in gross domestic product of 18%. There are some other records that were broken. For example, we had the largest current account deficit in the world, which a few years ago was 25% of GDP, and it went back up to plus 15%, which is a swing almost unheard of in modern economic times. We had, when our economy was overheating in 2008, we had 18% inflation, and this went all the way down to deflation in 2010. We had an enormous housing bubble. and I think this is a record as well, accumulated decline in terms of property values of 70% over a couple of years. Massive public sector wage cuts in 2009, 2010, and in some places are still going on. The average was 25%, but in some ministries and other agencies, it was 40% salary cuts. So imagine what a 40% salary cut means. You get a picture of what the pain was. Unemployment peaked at over 20% in 2010. It has declined slightly to about 15, 16% now. And it would be much, much greater if we had not seen a lot of emigration from Latvia westward to Ireland, Great Britain, other countries. We had the collapse and government takeover of Latvia's second largest commercial bank, which is called Parex, and was primarily because of the collapse of this bank and the threat it posed to the stability of the financial system in general that Latvia turned to the IMF and the EU in 2008 asking for a bailout package. The sum total of the bailout package was 6.5 billion euros, which in American terms or the terms of a large European country is not that much, but it was equivalent to 35% of Latvia's GDP. So in relative terms, a very large bailout package. Here's just a small graph. I don't know if you can see all of the things put together by an economist friend of mine that shows the trends over the last few years of some of the key economic indicators. You see the decline of GDP of 18% now slowly rising. The reason it's rising is because of the top red line, which you see a growth in exports. But you see private consumption and government consumption has declined a lot and it remains pretty flat. And gross capital formation on the bottom basically bottomed out and is slowly increasing, but the drop is huge. Why so deep a crisis? I think there are a number of reasons. One had to do with the banking system. Early on, we had reckless bank lending. Both Scandinavian banks that came in and were competing for market share, but local banks participated in this. During the boom years of 2005, 6, 7, you had banks increasing their credit portfolios by 60% a year, year on year. So in other words, they were giving money away to anybody who wanted it to buy a house, to buy an apartment, to buy a car, and very often not looking to see if the people would be able to pay it back. But also, people thought they people had an unwarranted optimism about the future and thought they could pay it back. This lending fueled a huge consumption boom, which led to this huge current account deficit. In other words, Latvia was importing much more than it was exporting. And people in Latvia went on a spending spree. There was a lot of repressed demand. People wanted to live the good life and live it quickly. After Latvia joined the EU, we had a lot of labor out-migration. at the time, it was circular migration. People would go to Ireland and Great Britain, stay for a while, work for 6 months, and then come back. This led to a severe labor shortage in the boom years, which led to a very tight labor market. And you had wage increases of up to 35% a year, basically, as companies in the public sector tried to keep, tried to attract labor. And this, of course, led not only to inflation, but also to undermine Latvia's productivity because these wage gains outpaced productivity gains by a long shot. And the government basically made some huge mistakes. You had a pro-cyclical policy response. A prudent policy would have been to save some money to cushion for the bad times. Latvia was spending in the red even in growth years. There was no break on the boom in consumption through taxes, and the government actually contributed to kind of the bust through its policy mistakes. And here I briefly hand the floor to my colleague Andris, who could talk about the role of the foundation in the crisis context.
Yes, good evening. Before I go to our response to the crisis specifically, I'd like to just mention the core work of the foundation, which continues throughout the crisis and we hope into the future. We have, the foundation has five core foci currently. The rule of law and good governance I will be partially addressing within the context of civil society and the elections that we're looking at right now, but it also addresses issues, the broader issues of anti-corruption and improving the judicial system. Good governance in energy issues was chosen by the foundation because energy is a question, although we don't have any extractive industries, around the question of energy, it's the nexus of good governance questions, including those of transparency and corruption issues which arise there. And it is not easy to look at these problems within the context of just the rule of law, but it needs to be seen in a complex fashion. In the integration area, we work on integration of the vulnerable groups, that would be LGBT, mentally disabled issues, and the like, Roma as well. There's a very small Roma population in Latvia. And the alienated. The alienated primarily being Russian-speaking youth and various other such groups, minority groups. Wider Europe addresses our relations and our knowledge of the development of countries to the east of the European Union. Primarily, we work together with Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, occasionally also with Belarus questions, but we also look at more pan-European issues within the wider Europe, and media, which I will be addressing more specifically. Our annual core budget is 1.5 million, but as I will be talking about euros, because the Latvian currency is hooked or aligned with the euro and goes up and down with it. And, but we have been broadening our approach through a number of new initiatives through the OSF Emergency Fund and the new media program. The social impact, one must say that the social segregation and economic stratification is leading not to solidarity, but to atomization and a focus on survival among most people. The economic downturn has led to a shrinkage of the fragile middle class and pauperization of the lower middle class, population groups that at least in the past have been more open to liberal democratic values. Of EU member states, and this is an interesting statistic, Latvia shows the greatest risk of poverty rate and the greatest inequality in income distribution, otherwise known as the Gini coefficient for all of the EU. The public infrastructure is deteriorating, and in the public infrastructure, I'd like to include healthcare and welfare issues. And more and more people, the state's safety net is no longer there. One of the greatest challenges we face is in awakening interest in open society issues, in a people focused on the challenges of not sinking into poverty and disillusioned by the state and all things political. Patterns of discrimination and exclusion, xenophobia, homophobia, anti-immigration and racism are widespread and stable. In this environment, advocacy and watchdog organizations are key to keeping these questions present in the public sphere and halting backsliding. Now, one of the means that we have had, fortunately, to address the social and partially the political impact has been through the Open Society Foundation's Emergency Fund, which was created by George Soros with $100 million for Central Eastern Europe, including Central Asia. And currently, the foundation in Latvia has used $3.9 million of that in a broad spectrum of initiatives addressing social and political issues, beginning with the most basic, which was the creation of a nationwide food bank, which was very successful. It was aimed at people that fell in the cracks, people who formerly had jobs but were not eligible for welfare, often with larger families. And this became actually rather popular for the amount that we gave for this program. There were over seven times that amount were donated in monies in kind across Latvia, and the program is still continuing. Through Children's Village outreach, very important are the family crisis centers, which lost local government funding. Community foundations are very direct access to grassroots needs. And a very large program that we did was the development of small schools into learning and community centers, which try to address rural and small town regions in a systemic matter means by helping them. Small schools have been under threat for a long time, and it helped them to actually utilize their local resources to bring together and optimize schools and other social services in the city, and looking into, you know, addressing unemployment issues and lifelong learning. And the final thing I would like to mention here is something we call the Culture Brigades, something that we found very interesting because it applies, it helps people in the arts area to joins them together with social causes, but also with social entrepreneurship. And we had a number of attempts here, and I think it's very important for the thinking in the region that entrepreneurship be awakened as a way of looking at things to give it sustainability and long-term development. Because many of the jobs that were there prior to the financial crisis, even if things go better, will not be there once we, as we climb out of the financial and economic crisis, and people will have to think differently to live on. Media. As we all know, there has been a global decline in traditional media. But this decline was made much more rapid in Latvia, and it was exacerbated by the financial crisis. Symptomatic of this was the sale and subsequent emasculation of the largest daily, Diena, which had been the liberal democratic flagship in Latvia. The media's role as a critical safeguard for democracy in Latvia is actually very much under threat. The collapse of advertising revenues is making print media, in particular, untenable, except as projects subsidized by powerful business and political interests. The budgets of public television and radio have been slashed, and investigative and quality journalism is rapidly declining. For example, in the private media, only the weekly news magazine IR, which means is, and in public media, the Latvian state radio's first program has any serious analytical journalism left. Some serious internet websites reach niche markets, and the rest are either mouthpieces of business and political interests or concern themselves with PAP. And let's remember that Latvia's media sphere is divided by language. The Latvian language market is tiny, and therefore all of the media crisis problems and the resolution of them is very difficult when you have a very tiny language market in which you're dealing. And the Russian language market in Latvia is dominated primarily by Russia's media, the Moscow media. Now, when the financial crisis started, we actually rejuvenated our media program in the foundation, and it's now been functioning since January 2010, and it's actually showing greater success than I would have imagined in stimulating various areas. And you can see the five areas in which we basically work. Right now there is new in general media legislation underway, and we're very much a part of trying to facilitate and form that it would be a very open public legislation. And there's also the issue of media ownership, which is a very difficult one. We have facilitated and helped the organization of journalists. The Journalist Association had become moribund, and they're very much, this new grouping is very much concerned with their own rights and needs and is plugging into the legislative change. And we now have an active press club. Perhaps the most interesting thing underway currently is a new investigative journalism center, which we're helping to facilitate the creation of for the Baltic states. It is meant for all of the three Baltic states, and it will be. It is starting up operation right now, as on the model of many of a number of other ones in both North America and in Europe. We work very much with journalist and youth education in new media models. We've had competitions for new media models. We had first one last year, and we'll be having another one this year. So we're having some sort of impact in this area. Niels?
Yeah, so the socioeconomic situation was quite serious. It remains quite serious. Foundation actively jumped in to try to cushion the blow as much as it could, but to keep issues of the open society on the agenda. And Latvia is now recovering. How is it doing this? You look at Greece, if you look at Portugal, you look at other European basket case economies, but Latvia is recovering, and one reason is responsible fiscal policy. You've had massive spending cuts and tax increases in line with the IMF EU bailout package, what many have come to term the internal devaluation. It's an export-led recovery, which means it's fragile because the global economy is still fragile, so far, there's an upward trend on the exports. But we've also have very weak trade unions. These kinds of cuts could never take place in a country with strong trade unions. But also, we have the immigration safety valve, which means that there's little unrest, but this will create huge problems in the medium to long term. Now we have four quarters of growth led by exports, and hopefully the last budget consolidation or last kind of budget cuts and tax increases for the next year and the last tranche of assistance from the IMF and the EU. This is just a little graph on GDP changes from 2001 to 2011. The orange bars are Latvia, but there's a green line and a white line. The white line is Estonia and the green line is Lithuania. So you can see that this was a pan-Baltic crisis. It was deepest in Latvia, and the recovery is weakest in Latvia, but it struck Estonia and Lithuania quite seriously as well. And there you can see the last four quarters of growth. This is thanks to Bloomberg. Now the politics of crisis. Because Latvia has faced a political crisis now for a number of years, an economic crisis was both a contributing factor to it, as well as a result of bad government. Latvia's 59th place in the Transparency Corruption Perception Index. Within the EU, it's tied with Slovakia, and we beat only Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, and Italy. We're not at the bottom. There are countries that are perceived to be more corrupt. If you read WikiLeaks, especially some of the stuff that came out last week, it's fascinating reading. It reads like a criminal novel. We have the overarching influence of several oligarchs, suspicious deaths of anti-corruption witnesses, corruption in the judiciary. We all knew this, but it was quite striking to see it in print in black and white and people called by their names and rumors finding their way into these cables. And ongoing investigations against various high-level officials, but very few high-level prosecutions. Here's a graph taken from the EU's, the Eurobarometer website. This is about trust in political parties. but I could have made a similar one for trust in government and parliament. The green line up above means tend not to trust. This is tend not to trust political parties. And the range since we joined the EU has been from 80% all the way to 95% now. So we have about 95% of the population in Latvia does not trust political parties. Make very similar graphs for trust in government and trust in parliament. So we're at the bottom of the heap within the EU with regard to trust in government. Social tensions led to one riot. It was basically social tensions combined with disgust at corruption and so on in January of 2009, Latvia's first riot. These are common, riots are common in many European cities, but for Latvia this was quite a shock. Over 100 people were arrested. Here you can see some police cars have been turned over, people throwing stones at the parliament and so on. This is in Riga, yes, in January of 2009. Ongoing political scandals in the last couple of years where the political elite has appointed either mediocre or politically biased judges, ombudsman, head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau. And it was actually controversy surrounding the Anti-Corruption Bureau that was one of the reasons that sparked the riot back in January 2009. Now, the last head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau has been fired for incompetence, and it was a good thing he was, and the office is vacant, and hopefully after the elections we'll have a new, good, hard-hitting Anti-Corruption Bureau head. After we had elections a year ago, after the elections in October of 2010, one of the so-called oligarchs, a guy called Ivars Lembergs, who's a mayor of Ventspils and one of the richest people in Latvia, became a kingmaker in the government. You had an anti-corruption party aligned with an oligarch party sharing government in Latvia. And in June of this year, the outgoing president came out and made the announcement that democracy has been privatized in Latvia, and he named three oligarchs, including Mr. Lembergs, and the president convoked a referendum, I think it was in August, not July, on dissolving a parliament. If he had lost the referendum, he would lose his post, but of those who voted, 95% voted in favor of dissolving the parliament. This is almost like a Belarusian figure. You don't get these kinds of figures in Latvia where 95% vote for one thing or another. So now, this is the reason we have early elections. This is a constitutional provision that has never been used in Latvia before, so we're on new political turf here. And the politics of these elections, essentially, it's a low-key campaign because the parties have very little money. They have no new ideas. It's mostly the same players, except for the president, after he left office in July, he formed his own party called Zutler's Reform Party. but other than that, the players are pretty much the same. And here I've grouped them into four different groupings. You have the fiscally responsible moderates, Unity, which is the party of the current prime minister. They were basically elected on an anti-corruption platform. Zutler's is the name of the former president who just left office. He created his own reform party. You have what I would call the fiscally challenged oligarch parties. By fiscally challenged, I mean they have a difficult time doing their math and showing how they're going to not give back money to the IMF and EU and not have Latvia collapse. And there you have the Greens Farmers. This is a party of Mr. Lembergs. And another oligarch, Schlesers, who after Zutler's created his reform party, changed the name of his party into Schlesser's Reform Party. This is a typical kind of a Russian political technologist kind of thing to do. You have the right-wing nationalists, All for Latvia Fatherland. Nationalists in Latvia means they hate Russians and Russia. And you have the moderate Russians. I call them moderate, they're called Harmony Center. I put moderate in quotes because if they have a cooperation agreement with United Russia and the Chinese Communist Party. So this is, by the standards of Latvian Russians, they're moderate, but if you look in the broader scheme of things, they have some strange friends. And they're a very motley bunch of people. Some are very European-oriented, some are very Russia-oriented. But I put it in quotes just so that people don't get too confused. What are the key election issues? First is how to deal with the IMF EU package. There are some who say we should not give it back. There are a couple of countries who have done this. I think Zimbabwe, a couple others, but not very many. There are some who say the outgoing government did a bad job. We'll be tougher with the IMF and the EU. We'll convince them to allow us to give it back later at lower interest rates and so on and so forth. Although there's very little room for maneuver there. But this is one issue that's come up. The other is stances on anti-corruption. And actually the name of Soros has become a pre-election issue. There's been a campaign, Mr. Lemberg's and the media beholden to him have organized a kind of a propaganda campaign against Sorosites or Sorosians or Sorosoids. And this is a code word for all kind of liberal Western-oriented intellectuals who want to destroy the national bourgeoisie and import unhealthy foreign values into Latvia. Basically, the name of Soros is mentioned quite frequently. Stances on minority policy, and particularly on the issue of history, which divides Latvians and Russians, are very a key issue as well. Stances on relations with Russia. You have less of a difference between various Latvian parties on this than you used to, but still there are some important differences. Big question is, will Latvia have an oligarch-free government after the next elections? And will the moderate Russians be in government? For the first time, they're being considered seriously as being potential coalition partners. And what does that imply? Does it imply changes, big changes in minority policy? Does it imply big changes in policy towards Russia? We're in the EU and NATO, so does it make a difference, really? My own view is that they have a pretty good chance of being in government. Here I turn the floor back to Andres to talk a bit about civil society in elections, because the foundation has been quite active in promoting civil society engagement.
One of the sort of interesting phenomenon, both last year, because we had parliamentary elections last year and this year, is that there are an increasing number of civil society activists that are actually joining the political fray, which from my perspective is a good thing, but because it's a small country, that means that, very bright and leading people are leaving the civil society sector to work to run for government jobs or parliamentary jobs. And I think this is a good thing. It's part of a phenomenon which also was supported by increased, popular manifestations prior to the referendum and increased engagement of informal groups that are showing themselves as never been shown before. So there, I would say in general, there is an increasing number there. The foundation both last year and this year has helped facilitate finance and co-finance various activities, and I think civil society is becoming is engaging in pre-election activities in a much more engaging and creative way than they have in the past. I mean, the four areas that I've mentioned below, both monitoring, media engagement, voter engagement, and youth engagement, the projects and the various initiatives tend to be ones that that address various things. They're no longer, we still continue to support in monitoring, monitoring of party financing, hidden advertising and use of administrative resources, which we have been doing since 2000. This is a very traditional approach. But in the last election and this election, we're supporting Transparency International in Latvia. They're having a candidate watch site, which is actually becoming very much used by the media, and not only by the media, but also individual voters and civil society organizations. What they've created is a very good database on all of the candidates and the parties and how they have not only addressed anti-corruption and transparency issues on the back, but there are profiles of these people and what are their financial connections, how they voted, and so on. And especially in this time where the traditional media is rather emasculated and has very little analysis, this has become an important resource for the broader media that still exists for information on the political candidates and the various parties. So it's having much greater impact than it would have in the past. This is basically, we call it they give also an evaluation of the reputation of the candidates. Then there are such things as find the candidates closest to your values website. You can match your values to find the values of individual candidates and parties to see what would be the most logical parties to vote for or individuals. Then there are, of course, broad public and media discussions on energy issues and with youth. There's a lot of youth engagement with blogs. First-time voter engagement with the candidates that we've been supporting, and such things as there's a TV program that they've copied from, actually it was from Canada, and it's called I Want to Be Prime Minister, and it actually was the most intriguing thing in the last year's election time, and we're having the same thing this year, and we're co-funding it, is where young people go through this whole series of challenges and trying to address issues, and there's voter, there's audience participation, and there's specialists, and it's actually a fairly high quality program that had very high ratings in Latvia, and it makes people think about what is needed to be prime minister. So I would say in the last few years, certainly on the one hand, voters are disillusioned, but there's a greater activity of both activists and a greater interest in the pre-election times.
Now I want to turn to the Russia factor in the region, not just in Latvia, but in the region. And what I will say about Russia basically relies on three books recently put out. One is called Latvian-Russian Relations, Dynamics Since Latvia's Accession to the EU and NATO, The Geopolitics of History in Latvian-Russian Relations, and Manufacturing Enemy Images, Russian Media Portrayal of Latvia. So I could talk about this for days, and I'll try to compact it as much as I can. What is the Russian agenda in the Baltic states? What are the aims? If you read through the policy documents and you analyze what Russia has been doing over the last few years, they have several different aims. One is political penetration, basically to maintain Russia's influence in the area, doing this both by grooming allies among the political elite, but also using minority issues to enhance their influence. The other is asserting the Russian view of history in the various memory wars that the Baltic states have been engaged with Russia, and I'll explain a bit what I mean by memory wars. Of course, there are military issues. There's a lot of spying going on in Latvia. We're kind of some huge spy scandals over the last couple of years in Latvia, but the core aim, I think, is deflecting NATO, deflecting kind of the having more NATO infrastructure present on the Baltic states and NATO policy. The Baltic states are interesting because they're members of NATO in terms of the military dimension. Energy issues, maintaining the dependence of the Baltic states on Russian gas, electricity, and other things. And economics, buying up assets, which they're doing a lot of now. Russia is politically quite active in the region, and this, of course, plays into the election campaign. United Russia has cooperation agreements with two parties in the Baltic states, with the Center Party in Estonia and with Harmony Center in Latvia. There were some very loud allegations of money being funneled to the Estonian partner in 2010. And over the last 2 weeks, you've had a lot of news stories about Russian political technologists. These are basically political technologists, I guess, is a public relations consultant, expert at manipulating the media and public opinion, being sent to help out their Latvian partner. Russia has links to controversial politicians in Lithuania. Viktor Uspaskich, who was a prominent politician who for a while fled to Russia because of charges that he was doing dirty money deals with Russian politicians, and now he's a member of the European Parliament. Kazimierz Prunskiene, who was the prime minister back in the early days of independence, who is so well-liked in Russia that she has been called a Duchess of Russia, has been granted this title, Duchess of Russia. And Rolandas Paksas, who was the only president, I think, in all of Eastern Europe, who's actually been impeached for financial impropriety and for his dealings with some very wealthy Russians. Russia also has people with Russian passports living in Estonia, Latvia, very few in Lithuania, but you have 95,000 citizens of Russia living in Estonia. You have 38,000 in Latvia. And of course, after the Russian-Georgian War, this was a cause of some concern because Russia justified its military action in Georgia by saying it wanted to protect its citizens. So all of a sudden, we began to look at how many citizens of Russia were living in the Baltic states. So not that many in Latvia, but very many in Estonia. If anybody's interested, I could talk about why later on. Russian perceptions of the Baltic region. Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania are often viewed as a single unit, seen as among the least friendly countries, not only in the region, but in the world, primarily because of their foreign policy orientation, their strongly held perceptions of discrimination, massive discrimination against Russian speakers, and the Balts as being historical revisionists. And along with Poland, the Baltic states are perceived as forming an anti-Russian axis within the EU and NATO. Here is some Russian public opinion data, which is by the Levada Center in Russia, quite a reputable outfit. And this is survey data from 2005 asking Russian respondents to name those countries which are the most unfriendly towards Russia. As you can see, in 2005 and 2006, Latvia was enemy number one for the Russian public. And then Estonia took over the baton in 2007 with the Bronze Soldier crisis. And then in 2009, after the Russian-Georgian War, the Georgians are number one, 62%. But after the war, Georgians don't look quite as threatening, 50% only now, but Latvia and Lithuania still 35 and 34%. And we have beat the United States in terms of how much we threaten Russia and how unfriendly we are, and we're quite happy with the status, and we're going to struggle to maintain it. But I think this is quite interesting, and I remember talking with the head of the Levada Center, Lev Gudkov. He said, these opinions are not very deeply held. That basically a lot depends on what the government is saying. And he said, we saw this with attitudes towards Poland. All of a sudden, when there was a warming of relations between Russia and Poland, and the political authorities started talking in more friendly ways about, or in more neutral ways about Poland, survey data changed very quickly. But this is a result of many, many years of media coverage and negative political discourse about the Baltic states. Of course, one issue of interest to Russia is Russians in the Baltic, of which there are the most in Estonia and Latvia. And a key issue has to do with citizenship. While the majority of Russians in Estonia and Latvia have citizenship of Latvia or Estonia, some have citizenship of Russia, you have a significant number of people who don't have any citizenship. They're called aliens in Estonia. There are 95,000 of them, or 7% of the population. In Latvia, they're called non-citizens. There are 319,000 of them. These are people who are eligible, who are allowed to apply for citizenship, but have not done so for various reasons. There's a language test. Some of them don't speak Latvian at all. There's a multiple choice history test. They don't want to take it. They feel they're entitled to citizenship automatically. Their status is stable enough, and it doesn't engender any hardships. So they're not happy, but they're not so unhappy that they want to do something about it. And this is an issue of great concern to Russia. Various European organizations have also raised it, but Russia regularly raised it. Also about the status of the Russian language, which was the lingua franca in the Soviet Union. It was a privileged language in the Soviet Union, and now its status, of course, in the last 20 years has declined significantly in all three Baltic states. where not only you have language regulation in the private sector, you have bilingual education in schools, and along with demographic changes, out-migration, so on, you have a decreasing number of Russian kids, so you have to reform the school system and close down some schools. And this has affected Latvians as well as Russians. But these are issues that Russia has raised. If you're interested about this topic, we put out a book in 2010 called How Integrated is Latvian Society? So I can talk at length about this if you have questions. Russia often claims that the Russians are victims of massive discrimination. What's interesting is that the European Union, it has something called the Fundamental Rights Agency, which is an EU agency based in Vienna. They did a survey of minority perceptions of discrimination throughout the EU called the Midas Survey in 2009. And they separated out different groups, Roma, sub-Saharan Africans, Turks living in various places. And they did Russians as well for all three Baltic states and Finland. And lo and behold, in which country do Russians feel most discriminated against? It turns out to be Finland, actually. And the relatively high figure for Estonia is probably due to the fact that the Bronze Soldier crisis was not in such a distant memory. So, but in terms of the standard kind of measures, at least perceptions of discrimination, the Russians themselves, particularly in Latvia and Lithuania, do not feel particularly hard and done by, which kind of goes against what you hear from Russia. Russia is very active in supporting its diaspora, raising the issue in the UN, other international organizations. It provides increasing amounts of funding for Russian language and cultural centers, for stipends and various educational projects, for NGOs. Some of these NGOs are linked to the political parties that they're friendly with. Media, not only do you have media broadcasting from Russia, but Russia is purchasing local outlets, or sometimes it's just purchasing journalists, and providing a lot of assistance to veterans, particularly veterans of World War II. And this leads me to the issue of memory wars. What you have between the Baltic states and Russia is what I would call colliding grand historical narratives, which are very difficult to reconcile. For the Baltic states, basically the story that the Balts like to tell themselves and others about themselves is one of Soviet occupation, about the legal continuity of the Baltic states since World War II, about suffering, particularly Stalinist deportations, and about resistance in various forms, whether some people look to the legionnaires, the people who are conscripted into the Nazi army as being symbols of resistance. Other people look to partisans who are called forest brethren or the nonviolent dissidents. Russia, of course, has a very different grand historical narrative. It's one about the expulsion of foreign enemies, whether it be Napoleon or the Nazis. Russia is seen as a defender, not an aggressor. Stalin, in this conception, is an ambivalent or even positive figure. And Russia is heir not only to Tsarist greatness, but to Soviet greatness as well. And here you can see that there are certain severe contradictions here. And this comes out particularly in relief when we talk about World War II. For Russia, World War II, of course, was the great victory. It was started by Hitler. Russian soldiers are heroes, liberators. It marked the emergence of the Soviet Union as a great power. And it's now their only usable past and is the core of Putin's state-building ideology. Yeah, the Great Patriotic War, exactly. For the Baltic states, World War II was a national catastrophe. It was started not only by Hitler, but also by Stalin. Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Russian soldiers are not heroes, they're occupiers, marked the loss of independence, the onset of repression, deportations, and so on. So you can imagine when these issues of history come to the fore, there's a lot to talk about between the Baltic states and Russia. A recent memory battle, of course, was in Estonia in 2007 when the government moved a World War II a statue commemorating the liberation of Tallinn to a military cemetery. It sparked riots. Latvia has a good fortune of having a victory monument that is too large to move. So we probably will not see the kinds of unrest we've seen in Estonia about this. Are there possibilities for a truce in these memory wars? My own view is it's unlikely because it's not mainly government-driven on the Baltic side. History is linked to identity. Young Russians need a positive identity. In the words of a Russian sociologist, for many young Russians, especially in the Baltic states, their parents are losers. They lost an empire, they lost their status, they lost their language. Their grandparents, they were winners. They won the great victory in World War II. It's much easier for people to identify with a positive role model than with somebody who's a loser. You see little coming to terms with the past in Russia, and the Balts, for their part, are pushing for recognition of their story, of their narrative within the EU, which, of course, brings this to the European level as well. Regardless, the Balts are trying to carry out a dialogue on history with Russia, learning a lot from Poland's dialogue with Russia on Katyn massacre and various other things. They're trying. It's going to take a while, and people are not holding their breath. I see. I will try to move more quickly. Military issues. Basically, it was only after the Russian-Georgian War that the Baltic states and Poland actually got NATO contingency plans, where our membership in NATO actually came to mean something in operational terms. In response to this, Russia organized some very threatening military maneuvers on the Baltic borders in 2009. Russia does not like NATO air patrols, which patrol airspace above the Baltic states. They regularly try to test the waters through excursions, and the last big one was in October 2010, when several NATO interceptors kind of escorted Russian fighter planes out of Baltic airspace. But interestingly, there's a lot of cooperation on the Northern Distribution Network, which is one of the routes by which America sends military assistance to Afghanistan, through the port of Riga, by train, through Russia, through Uzbekistan, and all the way to Afghanistan. And here, both Latvia and Russia are earning a lot of money from this transit trade from America and other NATO allies. Energy issues, very quickly. Dependence is the name of the game, and how to reduce that dependence. All three Baltic states are 100% dependent on Russian gas. Latvia does have a large gas storage facility, which is important regionally because it supplies also Estonia and parts of Russia. Balts disagree over the location of a new LNG terminal, which the EU has promised to co-fund. Lithuania is liberalizing its gas market fastest and thereby eliciting the ire of Russia. All three Baltic states are part of the Russian electrical grid, but Estonia and Lithuania both have links with other countries. Latvia does not. There are three, count them, three planned nuclear stations in the region. Which one will finally be built and quickest is a very interesting question, but this will have a massive impact on the regional energy market. One is in Lithuania, the other is in Belarus, and the third is in Kaliningrad. My bet is that the one in Kaliningrad will be built first. Oil dependence and transit. All three import oil from Russia, but you can import oil by sea. Estonia has some oil shale, but only Lithuania has refining capacity. Transit of oil through the region, which used to be a huge business, which is how our main oligarch, Mr. Lembergs, made his fortune, was largely redirected to Primorsk in northern Russia after 2002. Occasionally, you have some politically motivated disruptions to Lithuania through Estonia, but this is no longer as big a game as it was before Primorsk was built. Russian economic expansion. Seen a recent rise in indirect Russian investment via offshores. Now Cyprus has more Russian investment in Latvia than Russia does. And this is clearly Russian capital coming through offshores into the region. There are recent purchases of banks and media outlets in both Lithuania and Latvia, and a lot of real estate, especially coastal real estate. Large projects in the ports, attempted hostile takeovers of certain strategic companies. So Russia is taking advantage of the weakness of the Baltic economies right now to extend their economic influence. Prospects for Latvia after the elections, this is the last slide. Will we have a new governing coalition without the oligarchs but with the moderate Russians? My bet is that's probably the most likely option because Unity and Zotler's party have both said they will not jump into bed with the oligarchs again. And that leaves the moderate Russians or the right-wing nationalists as being the only logical cooperation partners. This is assuming that we don't have any big surprises in terms of the elections. What's the future of the IMF EU loan package? My bet is that Latvia will repay and repay on time, and that there's very little room for maneuver on this. And I think there's a consensus among most economists that don't have a lot of choices here. I think there are small changes that are possible in terms of anti-corruption, in terms of minority policy. What's interesting is that across the board in Latvia, everybody wants pragmatic relations with Russia, except for maybe the right-wing nationalists. But you'll see some tensions on issues of history, on issues related to minorities, on issues related to energy. Russia will continue to be interested in our region, will continue to try to attempt to co-opt elites, to influence minorities and to use them for leverage on other issues, and to buy Latvia. And with that, I close. Thanks for your attention. And all the books I showed are available in full text format on the webpage of the University of Latvia. So if you want them, you can download them all. And I guess now we're ready for questions. Thank you. Well,
many thanks to both of you for such a comprehensive and in-depth presentation. I really appreciate the portrait of Latvia you have painted here. I would like to abuse my right as the moderator and ask the first question. And then I will open up the floor to the audience. The recent census showed that the population of Latvia is actually significantly less than previously thought. I know that future projections are usually a thankless endeavor because a lot of factors remain unknown, but what, in your mind, is the future of Latvia given the fact that the brain drain, the immigration continues? What does it mean in terms of the demographics, in terms of the social fabric, in terms of the future of politics, and the future of migration and emigration? Where is Latvia going?
Okay. Latvia is going to face some incredibly difficult choices in the relatively near future, I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, because the options are relatively limited and they're pretty well known. What can you do when you have a demographic crisis? You can try to promote fertility. Doesn't usually work that well. It usually takes about 20 years before these people can enter the job market. You can try to promote the remigration of your emigrants. Recent research suggests that maximum 20% of these people are going to come back. You can raise a pension age. Very popular politically. You can try to bring in people into the labor market who are not active in the labor market, disabled people, Roma, women, so on. Not a whole lot of room for maneuver there. You can shrink the state. You can provide less services. And this actually is going to be what will happen to Latvia, is that services will be cut, the infrastructure will deteriorate outside of Riga, and that all of Latvia will live in Riga. And of course, the final option is migration. Have labor migration. This is highly unpopular in Latvia. Business will lobby for it very strongly, and the politicians will kick and scream. We already had some migration during the economic boom years from Moldova, Ukraine, Belarus, and we'll probably have it again, both illegal and legal and undocumented. What that means is that the old integration problems of the past are going to continue to plague us, because these labor migrants will be primarily Russian speakers. So the choices are very difficult, and what it does is the labor shortage will make a sustained economic recovery much more difficult. Already now you have foreign investors coming, got cheap real estate, decent infrastructure, especially around Riga, I'm ready to build a factory. Where are the workers? So what it means is that Latvia's growth will come up against labor shortages very quickly. Right now we have high unemployment. Already in some sectors there are labor shortages. So the choices ahead are very difficult, and none of them will win you elections.
I'd just like to add on to that two things. One is, let's remember the demographics in general, not just the out-migration. But Latvia has the most rapidly aging population. They are also the ones who are most consistently the voters that actually go to vote. So if we look at various issues of reaching the voter, that they would make certain choices, one third of the population is of the voting population is our pensioners, and they do vote, and the young people do not vote. So this is a very key thing, and it's also the attitude towards senior citizens is rather negative. I mean, this is you know, they're just seen as consumers in a certain sense, and I think there's a lot of rethinking that has to be done. And that's why I mentioned these things of the attitude of entrepreneurship or more creative ways of thinking how in the future to make things sustainable. Thinking out of the box is not very popular in Latvia, or it's not very much cultivated, neither is individual initiative in this area. So I mean, there are a lot of questions that need to be addressed with the aging population and what to do. As Neil says, there's 16% unemployment, but what are the, you know? But there's a deficit in many areas in Latvia that this 16% obviously cannot fill. So it's the mismatch.
Well, I mean, I didn't mention one other policy option: technology. This is what the Japanese do. No migration, robots. They put everything in robots. Robots working in old people's homes, picking people up, changing sheets.
Will they have Latvian citizenship?
The robots, yes.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much to both of you. If the audience has any questions, I would like to ask you to come up to the microphone and identify yourself and then ask your question. Thank you.
Hello, thank you for a very interesting presentation. Before I introduce myself, I just want to confirm that your books on the web are in English, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. My name is Dr. Polner. I'm president of Cinema Verite International, Inc., and I worked in Latvia, and I made a film called Corruption and Addiction in Post-Communist Societies, which is on my website, which is www.challengingfilm.com. So this was done in the past, and I think that, well, whatever. My question really is that in all of this deterioration, what's happening to the pensioners? Is there a great deal of homelessness? Is there an increasing rise in AIDS? And I could go on, but thank you.
The health situation has clearly deteriorated because people are waiting longer before they go to get help. And then, of course, diseases are more serious and much more difficult to treat. And among many of the migrants out of Latvia, you have young doctors and nurses who can earn much better money elsewhere, and they're actually being recruited from places like Finland and elsewhere. So the health care situation is a mess, and access to health has become more difficult during the crisis. What regarding pensioners? What you have is that pensioners, especially in the countryside, are often the only ones with some kind of an income. If the other people around are subsistence farmers or unemployed workers, then the pensioners, especially out in the countryside, are doing relatively okay. According to a lot of the research on kind of socioeconomic processes, it's not the pensioners that were hardest hit by the crisis, it's families with many children. And pensions have not really been cut almost at all during the crisis. It's political suicide to do so in Latvia, so that the pensioners have actually, in relative terms, they have done relatively well in the crisis, because if you have 25% to 40% salary cuts, if you have massive unemployment, if you have those things going on, and pensioners have continued to receive their pensions, that they have done relatively well. Most people, especially ethnic Latvians, also have a toehold in the countryside. with a country house, with relatives in the country. So many people have as a coping strategy relying on things that they grow themselves. This is more the case for ethnic Latvians than for Russian speakers and minorities. But that's been remittances. Remittances, according to the World Bank, are a very significant sum of money. People who send money back to their relatives, come back and visit, buy a car, buy an apartment, buy something, help out their relatives. But this also has huge social consequences, because very often you had one parent leave, or sometimes you have both parents leave and the child is left with the grandparents. So we have a whole generation of people being raised by their grandparents. And that creates all kinds of new problems that we are learning how to cope with. You want to add something?
I just wanted to say, I mean, many of the skills of the Soviet period are being reused in many ways. If you're talking about the countryside, I mean, people are starting again to can foods in the fall. I mean, in August, everybody's, bringing in the produce from the so they can get through the winter. And the skills of grandmothers bringing up children is, I think, there's a long tradition of this anyway. So it's a very, this is partially jokingly, but the basic skills that were there years ago are being reused as a social network.
Sorry, I had a second question, and you reminded me about it. When I was there, I remember there was such palpable hatred of the Russians. I was taken along, that's how I felt, I was taken along a beach, and it was literally pointed out to me that every other house, which was just gorgeous, was now owned by the Russians. So this has, you're laughing. You know where I mean.
In Jurmala, it's true.
Yeah. Jurmala, that's it.
Yeah, Jurmala, right. Jurmala is a playground. During the Soviet era, there were two places where the Soviet elite went on vacation. One was Crimea, and the other was Jurmala. And they've rediscovered Jurmala, and there are many wealthy tycoons from Russia that have bought up property in Jurmala. And actually, it's a sign. I have a Russian banker friend from St. Petersburg who bought some property. I said, "What's the attraction of Latvia?" He said, "It's close. Everybody speaks Russian. The prices are similar to those in Spain." And he said, "And Latvians have overcome their initial sickness of nationalism so that they deal with us now." and it's kind of an interesting perspective. Hatred, that's a very strong word. I think that, if you look at, I'm a social scientist, so I would say, okay, what would I look at? I would look at survey data. I would look at ethnic intermarriage. I would look at incidents of inter-ethnic violence or so on. Latvia has had almost no incidents of violence whatsoever. You saw the perceptions of discrimination data from the EU. You have relatively high, by the standards of the region, rates of ethnic intermarriage that have remained steady. If you ask people in surveys to rate ethnic relations on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 would be civil war and 10 would be peace, love, and understanding, both Latvians and Russian speakers have consistently over the last few years said 8. So not peace, love, and understanding, but pretty decent. Yes, there are huge differences of opinion on history, on minority policy, on relations with Russia, on NATO, on Georgia. But people live together relatively calmly and interact. And now the language issue is not that much an issue because the younger generation speaks Latvian. But when you talk about history, then the sparks fly.
And I'd just like to concur. And I think the basic divide is something visceral that comes out of memory or how I perceive my world. And it's actually that divide is on the memory and on the history and my identity. And that's where the clash is. It's not on, the daily
everyday life,
And if there's, and it's there, and it's something which is very, very, very difficult to change. And I don't actually know how to, because I feel that these sort of perceptions are things that you first learn in the family, so it's part of your psyche by the age of 4 and 5. And then there's obviously a cycle when you become socialized in school and university where this may change, and for many people it does change, and you get a different perspective. But I don't think we, you know, who work in this area have a good enough understanding of how to change this or how these changes happen. We have a few indicators, but obviously in much of the things that we do, we haven't been really that effective in there.
Well, these are, I mean, also have to remember, these are, this is a traumatized population. Ethnic Latvians, as well as Estonians and Lithuanians, are traumatized by Soviet rule, by deportations, repressions, which hit almost every family. If you looked at survey research in the early 90s, 1/3 of all ethnic Latvians and Estonians and Lithuanians had somebody in their family who was either deported, killed, or imprisoned. 1/3. The Russians are traumatized in a different way. The shift in their status from being the nation of state in a great empire, where they could use their language wherever, where they were considered to be first among equals, where they were highlighted for their historical role and the great fraternal assistance they gave to everybody. And all of a sudden, they're a minority in a country they might not have citizenship, don't know the language, and the country has complicated relations with the mothership. So this is a huge shift, and these things will not change that quickly. So.
Hi, my name is Inge Snipp. I'm from Uppsala University in Sweden. Right now I'm a visiting scholar at the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. I have actually two questions. I have to say my main focus is Georgia, so I'm a little bit less known with the Baltic region, but I have visited several times, more for holiday purposes. What I've noticed in Latvia and what my friends told me there was that it's a very xenophobic place to be. There's not like the sorrow of sight, as you were mentioning. I think also like in Estonia it was very physical to us. We were almost kicked out of a bar because we were foreign, and I never experienced such a thing. Well, there was, yeah, it was a very strange experience, and I wonder like how is this something similar in Latvia? What are the reasons for this anti-European Western stance really? Like how did it how did it happen? And my second question is really my main question, is the role of the oligarchs and their ties with Russians and other figures within Europe. For example, in Georgia, you have a lot of connections with the criminal activities in Vienna. You have the oligarchs living in London but sending money back to Georgia. So how's this going in Latvia? What are the ties, and how is this manifesting in the political spheres? I would like to see. My main reason for this question is because I didn't understand what the underlying reasons are that suddenly these oligarchs in Latvia are going into politics, and what the results are of these developments. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe first on xenophobia. Latvia is a very white and Christian or pagan place. Most visitors who have spent any time in a major European city or in the United States laugh when Latvians talk about diversity. Because I used to joke that Latvia will be in Europe when we build our first mosque. We don't have a mosque yet. Everybody is white. And religion is not important. These are among the most secular societies in the world, actually, Estonia and Latvia. And people are not used to people who are visually distinct. The Roma community is very small. Before the crisis hit, it was supposed to be between 10 and 15,000 people. Now it's probably much less because many Roma left. Jewish community is very small and mostly secular. So you have nobody, Russians, and it's impossible to tell a Russian and a Latvian apart. So these are very homogenous societies in a certain way. So anybody who comes in who looks different immediately stands out. You've had a number of racial incidents in all three Baltic states. Until now, both kind of racist movements in society have been very small. Skinheads, for example, in Latvia, security police tell us we have about 75 skinheads. Most people in Germany or Sweden laugh when I mention this. They're there, and there have been incidents. And you have day-to-day racism by people who just have never had any contact with somebody who's black. But Latvia is slowly becoming more diverse, primarily Riga, because Riga is a regional metropolis. It has all the foreign businesses and foreign students and so on and so forth. So they're becoming more diverse. It's slow. But you look at the data about hostility to immigration, per se, and you realize that we're going to have some big trouble. Until now, kind of anti-immigrant sentiment and kind of racist populism in the political arena has been a totally marginal phenomenon. We don't have a Haider or a people, you know, a right-wing populist party of that nature. We have these right-wing nationalists who basically don't like Russians and think they should go home. But this is all ahead of us. And it basically stems from isolation and from not having contact with these people. Regarding the role of the oligarchs, people use this term in a fast and loose way. According to the traditional Russian definition, what makes an oligarch? You have to have three kinds of power. You have to have political power, financial power, and media power. By these standards, Latvia only has one oligarch, Mr. Lembergs. The other two guys don't own media outlets. They have been in power. Yeah, they have some influence in media outlets, but they don't outright have a media outlet that works only for them, attacks their enemies, gives them a platform whenever they want. So by that standard, we have one oligarch. These guys have been in politics, all three of them, for a while. This is not something new. Mr. Lembergs has been mayor of Ventspils for 20 years. This is a city of 40,000 people through which Russia exported up to 12% of all of its oil in the 1990s. Can you imagine he was cashing in on each barrel of oil that went through? Earned a lot of money. Mr. Steele, the second kind of person who's called an oligarch, he was prime minister three times. He was deputy minister of agriculture in the early 90s when the privatization of the food processing sector took place. After privatization, he owned most of it. I wonder how that happened.
Transparency.
Mr. Schlesers is a businessman who became kind of a point person for Norwegian capital, many think was also Russian capital, coming in, setting up various retail outfits. But he's also a real estate developer, and there having political connections really helps because you can kind of change zoning provisions of various kinds if necessary. These guys used to be each other's throats. But they can make deals with each other, but they, would turn upon each other at the drop of a hat. They remain active behind the scenes in politics, basically because they made their fortunes through political connections. Their links with Russia are very strange. For example, Mr. Steele, one of his business partners is a guy called Yuri Scheffler, who fled from Russia. A multi-millionaire, a small oligarch by Russian standards, who fled from Russia and stole the Moskovskaya and Stolichnaya brands from Russia and brought them to Latvia. Jumped into bed with Mr. Steele, and they continue to do business together. Mr. Scheffler is hated in Russia. He would probably be shot by the FSB if he showed up again. You know, he works well with Mr. Steele. Mr. Lembergs has enemies everywhere. If you read this book on kind of Russian media portrayal of Latvia, they hated Mr. Lembergs because he had a monopoly position in the oil transit sector in the 90s, and he could charge very high transit fees. And they hated him. And I think he survived only through, there's some recent, both in WikiLeaks and some court case materials now in London, so I can say this without being sued by him. There are allegations of bribes of huge amounts of money in the East for him to have business coming through Ventspils. So he has both his partners and his enemies in Russia, and Mr. Schlesers as well. The latest deal in which there are links with the West, there's a family in Great Britain called the Rowlands, multimillionaires, who basically became the front people for the three oligarchs buying up the major newspaper in Latvia. It was, on paper, it was a Roland family that did it, but in reality, it was the three oligarchs that pitched in together and bought out the flagship Liberal Democratic newspaper. Using a middlemen from Great Britain who are respectable business people. So strange alliances are made. Many of them are short-lived. I don't know, you want to add anything to this?
I think you've covered it very well. There can be a lot. There's another question here.
Well, before our guest gets to the microphone, as a follow-up, these people obviously do not like giving up ground, power, and influence. How likely is their exit from a political landscape?
Well, it is a long-term process. I mean, two of them no longer, it's unlikely that Mr. Schlesser's will be represented in Parliament. Mr. Stjell will definitely not. But they will continue to exercise influence behind the scenes. The only real way to bring them out of politics is to put them behind bars. And this is a very difficult thing to do because they have a lot of money for legal defense. They have friendly prosecutors and judges in various places. There are holes in the legislation. And you have a leaderless anti-corruption bureau right now. So it's only when the judiciary and anti-corruption bureau work together and actually put these guys behind bars for some period of time that their influence will really recede.
First of all, thanks very much for the presentation. Keeping the Baltics on the agenda is no easy matter, given everything else that's going on in the world. I'm Chris Walker at Freedom House. Andres, you mentioned that it's hard to discern what sorts of steps would need to occur to have reconciliation or improve relations. But I'd be curious, both from you and from Niels Muzhniks, if Russia's media, in Russia today, 80% of the population, ordinary citizens, get their news and information from television, despite new media and the internet. Most of the ethnic Russians in Latvia today are consuming news and information coming from there. If that media were to be liberalized and the sort of illiberal messages that are narrowing the views and in some instances inflaming the views, or at least not constructive, if that were to change, hypothetically, if that were to be dramatically different and there was a different sort of tone and content, in the scheme of things, what impact would that have on the way in which the whole constellation of issues you've been talking about on the ethnic relations front would be dealt with? And then one other question, a larger question. I had the pleasure of spending a bit of time in Latvia in August. I spoke with a wide range of people across the country during that visit. I was struck by how gray and grim the views of the country were by ordinary people, despite the fact that some of the macro economic indicators seem better. I mean, people would say, this all looks good on paper. It means nothing for me in my daily life. At the same time, I would say that there's another way to look at the crisis in Latvia, which is the scope and the depth of the economic crisis, the catastrophe there, would have brought other countries maybe over the cliff. And in some ways, you can almost look at the resilience of the system with all of its warts, all the problems. You know, you talk about the privatization of politics. It's happening all across Central Europe. It's happening in the Czech Republic. It's happening in established democracies. It's happening in the United States to a degree. So I think some of these things that are happening are larger phenomenon that we're seeing in Latvia that are being amplified because the country is in such a fragile and vulnerable position. My question is, you know, What people were asking was, what sort of pathways are there, given the reality, given the sort of political landscape, given the clear problems with the economy and social challenges, given the ongoing challenges being posed from Russia, for better outcomes for the political elite, or at least maybe parts of it we haven't seen yet, to come up with better political programs? Right now, it seems like everybody's bunched up and shrinking. And that's not a good thing in a country that has this sort of challenges. So I'm just wondering, is there a part of civil society? Is there a part of the society, a young part that's still in the country that is showing some form of promise that we could say, okay, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, we'd actually see better outcomes than anyone's anticipating now? Or is it as grim as everyone seems to say it is?
Maybe I'll just start with the first question about the liberalization of the market that you mentioned. What would change the media market? I mean, and I would divide it in two things. And I think it was quite visible already in some of the slides and some of the information that Niels was giving. One thing is the visceral questions, as I would say, one of memory, one of, you know, are the national story, or you want to say, are the self-identification. To change something like that, you need something that, I mean, the poster boy is, or the poster girl is Germany, actually, you know, after the Second World War, where they spent, you know, 40 years of changing their education system and the attitudes, and somewhere where, you know, attitude engineering actually worked, you know, in the whole system. But that's something very difficult to change. I know, and that's the aspect that I don't know how you do value change or an understanding of relationships in that area. On most other questions, we could see how quickly the attitude towards the Baltics, you know, would fluctuate according to what is said by the general media. These are, as Neil said, these are frequently not deeply felt views about, you know, the threat from Latvia or the evilness of Latvia or so on and so forth on various other issues. So I would say a liberalization of the media market would allow for all of these issues, you know, there would be definitely a change. But on the visceral one, I would not see that.
In the sense of the market, the liberalization of the ideas and the messages that are transmitted, chiefly through state media, through the main weapons that are still dominated by Russian authorities, that would change. It seems to me that may be the...
Well, it's actually liberalization of both. You know, I mean, there's the market's very controlled in the media market, right? So, yeah. But I think that's very true for both.
I think it would have a very large impact because they really have a monopoly over especially the Russian-speaking public in Latvia. And you don't have this diversity of views. So I think the first thing, kind of a greater diversity of views in the major Russian electronic media would do, it would create confusion. Because certain things are no longer black and white and clear and cut. You know, if you had different views on the war in Georgia or different views on the Libyan war, all of a sudden people wouldn't know what is the right view anymore. I think that would be very useful and interesting. But I think, actually, it makes issues of ethnic relations much more difficult to manage when you have this third player, which sends very oftentimes unconstructive messages. For example, the message that the Russian media would say on citizenship. The citizenship law is unjust. We are criticizing Latvia for it. We are pushing international organizations. So the indirect message is, wait, don't naturalize, don't take the tests. The message on language is, we will have two state languages in Latvia as well as in all the other places. The indirect message is don't learn Latvian because we will achieve an official status for Russian. On history is no, there's no dialogue possible. But I think there is dialogue possible on all of these things. So I think it would have a huge impact. But also on Russian public opinion towards the Baltic states as well. Regarding the crisis, I think one thing is interesting. I get a lot of foreign journalists coming in and ask me, how do people survive this? I say, listen, these people have been through hell. People survived the Soviet era. They survived hyperinflation in the early 90s, a banking crisis in 95, the Russian ruble meltdown in 98. For them, this is just another crisis. For most people in Latvia, this is another crisis. I say them because I was not born and raised in Latvia. I moved to Latvia in 1993. So thank God I didn't have to witness the Soviet era there firsthand, except as a visiting researcher. So, and people develop these coping strategies. But pathways to better outcomes, there are signs of hope. When you have pockets of brilliance in a kind of a sea of mediocrity, where you have brilliant entrepreneurs doing really interesting things and creative things, where you have very socially innovative NGOs and media doing great stuff, but the general quality of the education in Latvia is very low. There are certain things where Latvia is very well endowed. Latvia has tons of wood. And if it doesn't develop, it has to develop a whole kind of set of industries around this resource that we have, both in terms of biomass and furniture and high value added products. Latvia has ports. Latvia has water. There's lots of water, which in the future will be very, very important. And Latvia has this interesting location. We're in the EU and NATO, but we know Russia and Russian pretty well, so it would be a shame not to take advantage of this, to be secure in the West but make money in the East. And the only way that we will be able to do this is actually to open up to greater diversity and immigration let Riga become a metropolis, a regional metropolis. It could be. It has this potential, I think. It's already much bigger than Oslo or Helsinki. It could be a big, diverse, interesting regional center. I think when you get outside of Riga, then it gets a little dodgier about what could you possibly do in Daugavpils or something. The port cities, they'll have business. But what do you do in the eastern part of Latvia? This is a tough one. So I think there are possibilities there. But you need people, if not your own, then imported ones. And you got to take advantage of your natural strengths, which hasn't really been done until now.
Chris Murphy, Longford Advisors. Your presentation seemed to assume the wisdom of fiscal austerity and internal devaluation. Yet 4 years after the crisis, you've got 20% unemployment. You've got GDP is not got back up to where it was, and I'm sure you've heard the comparison with Iceland before, but you know Iceland has done a hell of a lot better. You're talking about some signs of improvement in the macro situation, but in light of what's going on in the periphery countries and the rest of the EU, which is almost at least an even bet you're going back into recession, any signs of any shoots of growth you've got are likely to die. So I think you could expand on why you think fiscal austerity and internal devaluation was the proper policy.
I'm not convinced it was. I think that Latvia missed the chance to devalue when it would have made sense to do so. There is almost a religion of a stable currency. It's almost irrational in a way, because this was one of the big success stories after the chaos of the early 90s and hyperinflation, that we had a stable currency. And you could actually predict something and about what your life would be like, and because you didn't have massive inflation and you had this currency that you could actually exchange and so on and so forth. So I think certain policymakers, particularly in the Bank of Latvia, the central bank, basically almost had a fetish about having a stable lat and pegged to the euro and so on and so forth. And I remember at a certain point, one of our board members, he was an advisor to the governor of the Bank of Latvia. And I asked, what's the deal with devaluation? He said, it's too late. The only reason to devalue is to improve your export situation. Mm-hmm. He said, many of our major trading partners have already devalued. And I think he said something about a 20% devaluation would lead to only a very small increase in exports. So, if it were to have happened, it would have had to have happened very early, and politically there was no appetite for it whatsoever. Another big thing which people are going to be talking about a lot is, why did we bail out this bank? Incredibly expensive bank bailout. Why not let it go bankrupt? And there's a lot of discussion about, was this linked to corruption and so on and so forth, and it was clearly incompetently done, so that the loss that the taxpayer had to pay in the end was huge. But I know a lot of people now say, should let it go bankrupt. It would have hurt a lot of people, but in the end, mm-hmm. you know, the size of the bailout, if we had had to take one at all, would have been much, much smaller. But the argument at the time was that this is a systemic bank, that it would affect the stability of all the other banks and so on and so forth. You know, it had, in a country of a little over 2 million people, it had 200,000 depositors, so one-tenth of a lot of governments and local governments had kept their money there. So, I don't know, these are the two things that people are debating about what could have been done differently. Early devaluation, let the bank go under. I don't know, you want to add anything?
No, so I
don't think that there's, at least from my perspective, it's not necessary. I mean, the social cost was incredibly high. And when you look at the out-migration that it engendered, it really creates huge, huge problems for Latvia in the medium to long term. So I'm not convinced that it was the best way. But given kind of the political consensus on the stability of the currency, and it didn't seem within the realm of the possible. And if you raised this, I have some economist friends who raised devaluation. They were considered almost to be traitors, you know, playing the hands of Western investors, you know, want to speculate, you know, Sorosites. And it was almost unpatriotic to question the stability of the currency. And that's not a healthy situation to be in, where any kind of rational economic debate all of a sudden gets you painted as a traitor, a potential agent of outside influence. So I'm by no means a defender of this policy wholeheartedly. I think that I'm just trying to show how it happened and maybe why it happened, but not necessarily say that it was a good thing. Well, yeah, I mean, the whole euro, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with the euro? This is the odd thing, is that the whole bailout package was predicated on our joining the euro in 2014. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's no reason to have an inflation target so low, to have a deficit. And then the big question is, was this goal a smart one to begin with, to join the euro? Well, we kind of signed up for joining the euro once we joined the EU anyway, but maybe now is not the right time.
Anyone else? No? Okay, well, I think it's been a very informative presentation, and we might as well sort of end it now. Thank you so much to our speakers. I found this to be a very interesting briefing, and I learned a lot of new things. And thank you to the audience for coming and for expressing interest in this.
Thank you.